This is a CBC podcast.
After the fury of the second hurricane in 2 weeks, rampaging rain, deadly tornadoes, and terrible tearing wind, after all that, there are the stories of those in Florida who lived through it. Like this woman, dazed, sitting in a wheelchair in a parking lot in bare feet after water poured into her room in an assisted living center in the middle of the night.
The water was so cold, and I'm missing a shoe, my brace shoe, and I don't know where it is, my rim floating around somewhere. Scary.
It's a recurring theme, those who have less being hit so hard.
Your heart shatters for these people. We have water 4 feet up into their first floor here. Their church is gone. Their cars are gone. This is a neighborhood that doesn't have a lot. And the very little they had, they've lost everything.
And yet, Hurricane Milton didn't strike quite as hard as some had worried it would. But those who study what's happening say there's likely only rougher waters to come.
Climate change is certainly tipping the scales on these monster storms. These are record-breaking temperatures across the Gulf of Mexico. And the heat that is trapped in the vast surface layers of the ocean is the fuel.
Dr. Lemery, I wonder what goes through your mind as you watch people dealing with the aftermath of Milton?
My initial thought was, I hope these people can leave. We know that many people cannot. We know that some people won't. And they will be in, first and foremost, mortal danger from the storm. And then they will have to deal with the loss of perhaps family members, but certainly incredible damage to their communities, perhaps their loss of home. And the world as they know it, you know, their community, their neighborhood, may never be the same, and they may not be able to return home.
Before we go any further, I just wonder, can you introduce yourself to our listeners?
It's Jay Lemery. I'm a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine and director of its climate and health program.
And I'm Laura Lynch, and you're listening to What on Earth, where we bring you a world of climate solutions. Today, unraveling the harm of hurricanes on health long after the winds have calmed. A doctor diagnoses the challenge and how to meet it alongside a new generation of medical professionals ready and willing to speak out. Dr. Jay Lemery, hello.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thank you.
And I should note that we are actually speaking on October the 10th. It's the day after Milton made landfall. And it came just such a short time after Hurricane Helene, which claimed hundreds of lives. I'm wondering what effect you think this double whammy could have on people's health.
What happens is that when there's a 1-2 punch like this, there's competition for resources. They are not infinite. It can be devastating for those who lost everything or perhaps had mortal injury or had to experience flooding to then look for resources and realize there's a long line or there's maybe not as much as they thought.
When you say resources, what do you mean? Are you mean hospital beds, doctor availability, that sort of thing?
It can be many things. It can be they need medical care and perhaps their hospitals are taken offline or more likely the infrastructure that supported the clinics and their primary care are now disrupted, right? So we forget in those communities, there are homes, but there's also businesses. And many of those businesses are doctor's offices. And when people cannot access their regular care, people have long-lasting morbidity and exacerbations of their chronic disease because they're not able to access their regular care, get their medicines, have their blood pressure checked, visit with their doctors, because all that is disruptive. It may be disrupted because they've had to move. They may be disrupted because there's the transit that got them there is not working, or their doctor's offices themselves may be displaced.
And so you're talking about things that are going to happen like weeks and months down the road. Within the days, though, of this happening, what are the immediate risks to people's health?
The first thing we think about is the mortal danger from, you know, flying debris and storm surges and extreme flooding, right? These are things where if people get trapped or more accurately can get smacked with something fast moving, I mean, that can be a mortal threat, right? That can end their lives. Flooding can contribute to drowning and people getting trapped. What we then see, you know, a day or two after is in this aftermath, people are returning to their home. Their yards are full of debris and broken glass and hanging tree limbs, or perhaps live electrical wires, or you know, pools of water hiding, you know, sharp objects. And as people are sifting through their debris, there's a great many that are of recorded injuries where people end up getting cut with things or have crush injuries or even exposure where they're out there working in the hot sun, as opposed to normally they have access to air conditioning and clean water where they may not have that. So these are all the things that put tremendous stress on people, particularly those, you know, that are older, they're geriatric, they have less physiologic reserve.
What needs to be happening right now to prevent more death and injury in Florida?
I think the first thing that we have to think about is what resources can be mobilized for the resilience of those damaged communities. Is the Red Cross present? Are there disaster response hospital teams, disaster medical teams that come in, and they're full of physicians and nurses that are there, and they set up a tent, and it's a mobile treatment unit where they can do minor injury treatment as well as major injuries and resuscitations.
You speak from experience. You were part of the medical relief teams who went in after Hurricane Katrina in 2005.
We need help. That's all we need.
Help!
We just need
help.
What did you learn from that?
Yeah, so what I learned is that these are absolute zones of destruction where normal, functioning, resilient neighborhoods cease to be livable. There are entire communities that the houses were condemned. They were waterlogged and unsafe for human habitation. And these are entire neighborhoods. We saw people with all sorts of injuries who had gone back and tried to salvage whatever was in their homes, and many of their homes were destroyed. So they're sifting through broken glass and sharp shards of wood and perhaps unstable overhanging second stories, looking for pictures and photographs and things like that. One horrible scenario was we actually found a deceased person that had been yet to be documented and recovered.
This was
a week after. Yeah, the week after. So, you know, that's obviously someone's family member. And
that must have been hard for you, though, too.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, we're there to help, but you see things that are that bring it home. And I was happy to be there. I was happy to be able to help people that were in such desperate straits. When you're there, shortly after the hurricanes move fast, and then, you know, the sun comes out and it's a beautiful day. And you just look around and there's such a discordance between the nice weather and what just happened. Hmm. And these are, I think what's most telling is that people get help immediately. And I think what we forget is that they'll need help for months and years. Well, when you lose your home and have no place to go and maybe don't have the family resources to tap into, you know, that's very, very challenging. Where do you go after that? And how do you restart a life?
Scientists believe that climate change is leading to more intense hurricanes. So what should governments be doing to mitigate some of the longer-term health impacts?
I'm a physician, and my basic premise is that climate change is a health risk, and nothing is more evident than hurricanes. I think at a larger scale, we have to go to the root problem, right? We know this from disease, right? When we are trying to treat somebody for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and they need oxygen or other interventions, you know, the best thing they can do is not smoke in the first place, right? So it's the preventative medicine. And in this case, the best thing we can do is tackle the root cause, which is carbon in our atmosphere. We have more and more carbon from a carbon-based economy. These are policy decisions. None of this is easy, but what I try to confer upon anyone I might talk to, that this is health risk. And if we understand the risks, then it becomes important to us because everyone cares about their family's resilience and their communities and the places they grew up. And of course, their children and grandchildren. So if we can absorb that as being a risk, then we think about and we're concerned about it and we act on it, right? So this is just, it's a very basic proposition. And I think when you frame it like that, we can share the medical risks from the providers who are trusted messengers on these things. And we have to use our voice and say, you know, we're your healthcare providers. You know, we're physicians. We know sickness. This is sickness.
You talked earlier about how the elderly were more vulnerable and more at risk in disasters like this. There's a new study out in the journal Nature that finds that for any given hurricane or tropical storm, a Black person is 3 times more likely to die than a white person experiencing the same disaster. So I wonder, from what you've seen, why is that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it comes down to how we understand vulnerability. And this is socioeconomic vulnerability. We know that people of color tend to be more exposed to urban heat islands, you know, less, more blacktop in a city and less green space. And so there's historic redlining of communities where people of lower socioeconomic means live, and they tend to be people of color, and they tend to be in flood zones, right? The less desirable places in urban areas. So that was certainly one of the phenomenon in Katrina, where the low-lying areas, you know, low below the levees, were the ones that were disproportionately flooded and rendered unlivable from just the water damage and mold. And they tended to be communities of color. So it's not surprising, this statistic. I think it just reflects what we already know, which is kind of our the lens of vulnerability with which we think about who's most at risk from climate change.
Now, you are, as you said, the co-director of climate and health program at your university, and you talked about this a bit already, but how equipped do you think doctors are to respond to climate disasters?
Certainly, what I would hope is that physicians all over the world look at these disasters and think about the health consequences and think about the drivers of that. You know, what caused this? Why is this happening more? And why is this more intense? And then, you know, from that lens, be able to say, hey, I need to be a voice to say that climate change is a threat to humanity. It's a health threat and something we're going to have to deal with. We're experts in health, right? That's what we are. So we have to raise our hand and point that out as experts in health.
I gather that's what you see as your personal role as a doctor when it comes to climate change.
Yeah, at this point, my goal is to be a clear voice for that, but also think about where can we best use our resources. I'm an academic physician. I work in a medical school. And in that regard, my job is to scale up a climate savvy healthcare workforce. So I think about training physicians and nurses and physical therapists and pharmacists and say, listen, we need to get you thinking about this as well and give you the expertise to go forth and be credible, knowledgeable, effective leaders and use your health voice so we can keep pushing on this and change the risk assessment of society.
Now, I know you're not a politician, you're a doctor, but you can't ignore the fact that the United States is in the midst of an incredibly divisive election campaign.
That's the global warming you have to worry about. Not that the ocean's going to rise in 400 years, an eighth of an inch, and you'll have more seafront property, right, if that happens.
Well, the former president had said the climate change is a hoax. And what we know is that it is very real. You ask anyone.
I'm wondering how hopeful you are about the future of conversations about climate in the United States.
That's a good question. We've seen progress from the traditional climate deniers and the folks that maybe haven't think that climate change is an important issue. And so we've seen that, and that's actually a good thing. I will say that I very much support the current administration and the work that they have done to invest in solutions around climate change. And I think we don't know what's going to happen, but clearly, you know, that would be devastating to lose that momentum at such a critical time.
Well, what do you mean when you say you've seen progress when it comes to climate deniers?
Well, I say that a lot of the denialist voices used to be perhaps a majority of a large segment of the political population in the United States. And over the last 8 years or so, we've seen more progress on that, where there's, you know, soft consensus that, hey, this climate change is a problem, and acknowledgement that we've got to do something about it. Now, the policy solutions are still quite different, but I think it is important when everyone in the room agrees there's a problem, then you can start thinking about solving it. When half the room doesn't think there's a problem, you're stuck in the water,
so to speak. Dr. Jay Limmery, thank you so much for speaking with me.
A real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's all for us. Remember, the show is available wherever you get your podcasts. We bring you 2 episodes every week. So share one with a friend, because it really does help us out. The show was put together by Danielle Piper, Rachel Sanders, Nick Logan, Matthias Wolfson, and Catherine Rolfson. I'm Laura Lynch. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.